A year ago, at this event, we met amidst the worst economic climate since the Depression. Commodity markets were in upheaval. Investment dollars had evaporated. Gasoline demand was falling, production costs were rising, plants were closing, and the very foundation of this industry and our economy was shaking. At that time, I summoned Winston Churchill to admonish you, when you're going through hell, keep on going. Well, you did. You persevered. You charted a steady course through treacherous economic times. You continued to expand in the face of a flagging economy. You opened new markets. You seized new technologies. You met the challenges of increasing production and infrastructure, and you have come through the economic storm a stronger, perhaps a bit leaner, but surely a wiser industry as a consequence. Now we have pulled down the curtain on the first decade of the new millennium, a decade that ushered in a new era of American motor fuel policy and marketing, a decade when ethanol grew from a niche Midwest phenomenon with barely 1.5 billion gallons of production to a national fuel blending component with more than 13 billion gallons of capacity that today is used in more than 80% of the nation's gasoline, a decade that saw the enactment and then the expansion of the most progressive renewable energy policy in the world, the Renewable Fuel Standard, which established ethanol as a ubiquitous component of the motor fuel market and promises to displace 36 billion gallons, or roughly a quarter of the nation's gasoline by 2022, a decade that ushered in a new climate of opportunity for renewable fuels. And now I can say again, with confidence and conviction, that the state of the U.S. ethanol industry is strong. We are rebounding from the recession that has taken its toll on every industry. We are responding to every attack that our adversaries are making against us, and we are ready to take another giant step toward energy security, economic security, and environmental security for all Americans. Now, I'm not suggesting that all our troubles are behind us. They are not. And this year in particular will challenge this industry in new ways and as never before. We must break through the blend wall. We must address questions about ethanol's carbon footprint. And most importantly, this year, we must extend the tax incentive for ethanol. 2010 truly will be a seminal year in our industry's history. So today, as I summon Winston Churchill again, it is to remind us that a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. You know me. I'm an optimist. I see our political and marketplace challenges, and I see opportunity. And with what I have seen this industry do over the past year, you must be optimists as well. Consider what you did in the face of unprecedented adversity last year. With an economy in a free fall much of the year, you grew by 15%, reopening 14 plants that had been previously idled, starting up 8 new plants, and adding 1.5 billion gallons of capacity. Increasingly, these plants are opening outside the traditional Midwest. Just last week, plants in North Carolina and Pennsylvania prepared to produce their first gallons of ethanol, extending the economic benefits of ethanol to communities previously left behind by the Renewable Energy Express. This level of economic development contributed about $53 billion to the gross domestic product last year, providing a much-needed boost to a sagging economy. In an economy hemorrhaging jobs, with unemployment hovering around 10%, you continue to provide real American jobs. Indeed, this industry is now responsible for nearly 400,000 jobs, good-paying jobs across the economy, helping to raise household income by some $16 billion. And because ethanol plants are built in rural communities where investment and hope are rare commodities. Often these plants represent the difference between opportunity and stagnation. The production of 10.6 billion gallons of ethanol last year helped reduce oil imports by more than 364 million barrels, enough to tell Hugo Chavez, "No thanks, we don't need you for the rest of the year." It's enough to save consumers more than $21 billion and providing a down payment on the ongoing struggle to wean this nation from its dependence on imported oil. And perhaps most importantly for a nation and a globe, searching for answers to the planet's rising temperature, the production and use of ethanol in 2009 reduced greenhouse gas emissions by some 16.5 million metric tons, the equivalent of taking 2.7 million vehicles completely off the road. Now, my friends, these are tangible benefits of the nation's commitment to renewable fuels. These stats provide practical support to the energy, economic, and environmental promise of ethanol. We should all have these facts at our fingertips to refute the naysayers who somehow remain unconvinced that we can grow our way out of our dependence on imported oil, and the know-nothings who ignore or deny the very real price we pay for our addiction to fossil fuels. Our industry knows all too well the economic cost of that addiction. As the dust settles on the worldwide economic collapse that affected commodity markets, credit markets, unemployment lines, and the pocketbooks of every American, more and more analysts are recognizing that the catalyst of the recession was the skyrocketing price of oil in the summer of 2008. Now, don't take my word for it. As noted in testimony before the Joint Economic Committee last May by Dr. James Hamilton, a noted professor of economics at UC San Diego, quote, that oil prices made an important contribution both to the initial downturn as well to the magnitude of the problem we are facing today seems to me to be indisputable. But the cost of our addiction is more than economic, isn't it? Who among us does not know of a brave young American who is serving or has served his country to protect the free flow of oil from the Persian Gulf? I've got a brother-in-law that's about to serve his fourth tour of duty over there, this time as Chief Master Sergeant in the Army Reserves. But who among us is not tired of our nation's energy, economic, and geopolitical destiny being tied to our ability to access liquid gold from the desert sands of the Persian Gulf? I'm not just tired of it. I'm offended by it. I'm disgusted by the notion that this great country has to plead for increased oil supplies from regimes that despise our way of life. I cringe when I see the excesses our petrodollars are financing for the elite few benefiting from the oil economy, and I am incensed by every casualty report I hear from Iraq, knowing we wouldn't be there at all were it not for oil. Nobody should die because we have failed to wean ourselves from oil. Thankfully, there is growing support for the domestic renewable energy industry. And the ethanol naysayers, while no less determined, are increasingly losing credibility. Look how silly the food versus fuel debate looks today. In 2008, ethanol was the cause of rice shortages, pasta riots, and the increased price of everything from popcorn to tortillas to beer. We caused Pilgrim to file Chapter 11, Smithfield to close plants, and Tyson to cut production. Well, with the media frenzy dissipated and the benefit of hindsight and data, most economists now acknowledge what we said all along, the skyrocketing price of oil, speculation in commodity markets, and monetary policy were responsible for food price inflation, not ethanol. To emphasize the point, look what U.S. farmers did last year. Despite a wet spring that delayed planting, a cool, dry summer that slowed growth, and a wet fall that made harvest one of the latest ever, farmers still produced the single largest corn crop in history, 13.2 billion bushels. and shattered the previous yield record by producing an astounding 165.2 bushels per acre on average. Farmers fed more livestock, exported more grain, and yes, processed more corn into ethanol, and yet corn stocks grew. In the epic battle between food and fuel, the American farmer won, demonstrating to all but the most closed-minded skeptic that the productivity of American agriculture can meet the growing demands for grain in all its markets. We need to remind policymakers that the remarkable increases in yield and efficiency of the American farmer over the past decade didn't just happen by accident. These gains in productivity would not have been possible were it not for the increased demand for grain used in ethanol production. Because our industry has become the single most important value-added market for grain, farmers have been able to invest in new equipment, and seed companies have been able to hasten commercialization of new technologies that combined have improved yields and efficiencies to the record levels we see today. Consider for a moment that all of the increased demand for grain used in ethanol production in 2009 was met by increased yield, not increased acreage. Also consider, as you know, that a third of every bushel of grain we used is returned to feed markets across the country in the form of a very high-protein, high-value feed. This fact is often ignored, and it distorts the effect of ethanol production on grain markets. Even USDA, a strong proponent of grain-based ethanol, to be sure, contributes to the confusion by reporting the gross amount of corn used in ethanol production without accounting for distillers' feed. On a gross basis, the 3.8 billion bushels of corn used in ethanol production in 2009 represents 30% of the crop. But when the use of DDG is considered, the net amount of grain used in ethanol last year was only 21% of the crop. It's an important distinction. The 30.5 million metric tons of feed produced by ethanol biorefineries last year was the equivalent of the total amount of grain fed to cattle in the nation's feedlots. We need to stop talking about feed versus fuel and start a meaningful conversation about how we are going to preserve the farm economy as grain demand again falls behind production because increases in yield outpace both feed and fuel markets. Note that the largest increases in the demand for ethanol created by the energy bill incurred in each of the past 2 years. Future demand growth is slowed by the RFS schedule, and there's no reason to believe yields will slow commensurately. Farmers have done their part. Our industry has done its part. Now policymakers need to do their part and unchain the potential of American agriculture to feed and fuel the world. And we can. Now, the ethanol naysayers have also exaggerated the carbon footprint of grain-based ethanol. These naysayers don't produce any renewable energy. All they've done is manufacture an interminable controversy about international land use change. Thankfully, this has also suffered from the clear lens of research and science. 2 weeks ago, EPA released its much-anticipated RFS2 regulation. It included EPA's assessment of ethanol's greenhouse gas impact. The final rule reduced the supposed ethanol land use change impact by more than half. It concluded a 2022 natural gas-fired ethanol plant will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by some 21% compared to gasoline, even when saddled with questionable assumptions about land use. In fact, 49 of the 51 pathways EPA studied showed reductions in carbon. 34 pathways showed reductions greater than 20%. 23 corn ethanol pathways showed reductions greater than 30%. And 11 corn ethanol pathways showed reductions in carbon greater than 40% relative to gasoline. Only a few coal-fired pathways without any mitigation whatsoever showed increases in carbon. Cellulosic ethanol pathways are even better, ranging from 73% to 130% better than gasoline. Those are meaningful reductions in carbon, and significantly better than where the agency's analysis stood when it proposed the RFS program in May. It reflects improvements to the analytical tools that were suggested by the RFA and others regarding yields, co-products, and modeling assumptions. It also is significantly better than the contrived analysis being used by the state of California in its low-carbon fuel standard that suggests irrationally that somehow corn ethanol is worse than gasoline. But I will tell you candidly and with great respect to the representative from EPA who will speak on this issue shortly, that the analysis is still fundamentally flawed by the slavish devotion to the ill-conceived notion of international land use change. Without international land use impacts, ethanol's carbon profile would be 52% better than gasoline. The whole notion of international indirect effects, the theory that grain used in the production of ethanol must be replaced by grain grown somewhere else in the world to meet increased food demand, is suspect and belied by the yield data I talked about earlier and the models that suggest a linkage between increased biofuels and deforestation are simply wrong. Deforestation is caused by illegal logging, cattle ranching, and subsistence farming, not ethanol. Indeed, deforestation has decreased as ethanol production has increased. There is no linkage and there is no justification for a regulatory framework that penalizes ethanol for a consequence it does not cause. The debate on this issue will continue, and EPA has acknowledged it will further study international land use and make changes when appropriate. In the meanwhile, the RFS program is indeed a workable program, and I congratulate EPA for the work that they've done with all stakeholders to resolve so many issues in a constructive and collaborative fashion. Now, in 2009, there was a new fuel conceived. Enthusiasm for it spread like wildfire across a dry, windy plain. Oil companies had begun espousing the wonder of so-called drop-in fuels, alternative energy resources that are infrastructure compatible. They're cheap, and they'll soon be abundant. Indeed, at times over the past year, it would seem that the biofuels agenda had been hijacked by oil, and the only path forward was for biofuels to morph back into petroleum. Don't get me wrong. I'm a firm believer that we need every alternative energy resource. And if there are other molecules that can displace petroleum, I say bring them on. Make them happen. But as happens in Washington all too often, schizophrenia besets policy priorities, and we lose focus on existing and near-term opportunities in favor of the next new thing. But here, too, the ethanol critics have been slowed by a return to reason. On the same day EPA released its RFS rulemaking, the White House released its Biofuels Working Group Action Plan. It represents a new approach to biofuels policy that promises to coordinate federal action to assure the 36-billion-gallon RFS is met by 2022. The paper reflects President Obama's vision that the existing industry provides the foundation upon which technologies will continue to evolve. It's an inclusionary, not an exclusionary, blueprint. The paper notes, quote, first-generation corn grain ethanol is a critically important renewable fuel source that is lowering our reliance on foreign petroleum fuels, and cellulosic ethanol will soon be contributing as well. To reach and exceed our biofuels targets, we will need to take a new strategic approach that continues to support the existing biofuels industry and accelerates the creation and rapid commercial deployment of new technologies so our nation's effort to establish our advanced biofuels industry are met. Now, that's a vision I believe we can all rally behind. It's a thoughtful recognition that we cannot develop second or third or fourth generation biofuels without a vibrant and profitable first generation. It accepts that biofuels technologies must be evolutionary, not revolutionary. Indeed, that evolution is happening before our eyes today. At least 28 cellulosic ethanol plants are in various stages of development. They'll provide more than 170 million gallons of carbon-reducing ethanol. Now, commercialization has been slowed by the collapse of credit markets over the past 18 months, and significant challenges remain. EPA's RFS rule suggests that about 5 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol will be produced this year, far less than the 100 million gallons that were envisioned when the RFS was passed. It will be important for EPA to continue pushing hard on future RFS cellulosic obligations in order to provide a growing market for that industry. But the single most important thing that the government must do to assure the successful deployment of cellulosic ethanol is to reform the loan guarantee program so that it works for liquid transportation fuels like ethanol. The existing one-size-fits-all loan guarantee program that demands biofuel producers secure long-term offtake agreements similar to those possible in the power generation industry must be replaced with a more flexible approach that recognizes how ethanol is sold today. Other changes are going to be necessary as well. But here's the bottom line. Congress directed the Department of Energy to develop a loan guarantee program to get these high-risk technologies across the Valley of Death. Right now, the program is only making that valley longer and harder. Assuring production through the effective loan guarantee program, it's the beginning. It's not the end of a coordinated effort to assure the success of biofuels, developing, new, and existing. The market for these fuels also needs clearer definition and must meet the targets established by the RFS. 36 billion gallons of biofuels cannot be met by 10% ethanol. It cannot be met by 15% blends. It likely cannot be met by ethanol blends alone. The blend wall is not a talking point. The blend wall is a mathematical reality that demands a coordinated and concerted response. Look at the growth in ethanol markets in just the past 3 years. We've built markets in parts of the country where ethanol has never been used. The RFA has worked with state regulators to tear down regulatory barriers to ethanol. The infrastructure for ethanol has expanded exponentially, including new unitrain-capable terminals, transloading, and today, even ethanol transport in pipelines to this very city. In 2010, ethanol will be blended in about 90% of the nation's motor fuel. That's an amazing accomplishment. But it also means the proverbial blend wall is upon us now. The Department of Energy needs to accelerate its testing of E15 and E20 blends. EPA needs to evaluate that data and issue a fuel waiver applicable for all vehicles as soon as possible. The response to Growth Energy's petition in December was promising, as EPA recognizing what we've all known, that there's no data submitted indicating any potential problems with E15. But it was troubling as well by the agency's suggestion it would provide a waiver only for 2001 and newer vehicles. There is no data to suggest any unique issues with older vehicles. And the bifurcation of fuel and vehicle markets cannot be resolved with labeling alone. A full waiver for all motor vehicles must be our objective. We need to prime the pump for the continued market development in higher ethanol blends and E85 by dramatically expanding the availability of blender pumps. Now, working with the American Coalition for Ethanol and with funding from the National Corn Growers Association and 11 state corn grower associations through our Blend Your Own Ethanol program, the RFA is on course to put more than 5,000 blender pumps in high-density population areas over the next 2 years. Marketers across the country are finally recognizing the enormous benefit of simply providing their consumers choice. We need to do all of this regulatory work and market development, and we will. But my friends, nothing is more important in 2010 than securing an extension to the federal program that has built this industry. The tax incentive is scheduled to expire on December 31st. It must be extended this year if this industry is going to continue to grow and evolve, providing the foundation for future development and even more sustainable technologies. The volumetric ethanol excise tax credit, the cellulosic ethanol incentives, the small ethanol producer tax credit, and the secondary tariff should all be extended. Let this be our clarion call. The federal ethanol program has worked. It's building an industry, creating jobs, stimulating investment in new clean energy technologies that are going to power our economy for generations. It can, as noted by President Obama, bring new jobs, greater economic vitality to rural America, increased energy independence, reduced economic vulnerability to volatile oil prices and uncertain supplies, technological and industrial leadership in renewable biofuels, and reduced global warming pollution. But political capital is not limitless. It should be used wisely, particularly given the dysfunctional Congress that will provide precious few legislative vehicles to get an extension to the President's desk. In my view, anything that distracts from our primary legislative objective this year threatens the very foundation of this industry. The failure of the Congress to extend the biodiesel tax credit should be a sobering reminder not to take anything for granted. There's support for biodiesel, and it very well may get extended at some point this year, retroactively. But a retroactive tax incentive is no consolation for an industry that today is shuttering production facilities at an alarming rate. That cannot be this industry a year from now. Now, some will say there's no need for a tax incentive when the industry enjoys a mandate. But creating demand for a product does not assure that that market will be met with domestically produced biofuels. We shouldn't be trading our dependence on imported oil for a dependence on an imported ethanol. Some will say that the tax incentive has been in place too long. And in this budget deficit environment, it's time to phase it out. But it's exactly because the budget is tight that we must extend it. The tax incentive saves the government money by reducing farm program costs, increasing tax revenue, creating jobs, and improving our balance of trade. Every dollar invested by the government in ethanol production has returned $7 to the U.S. economy. That's an investment we cannot afford to shortchange. Some will say it's time to index the tax incentive to the price of oil, such that it is reduced as the price of oil increases. But beyond the complexity such a regime would entail and the uncertainty it would create in the market, I am of the view that as the oil price increases, we need more investment in renewable energy technologies, not less. When oil prices are rising would seem to be exactly the wrong time to increase the tax on renewable energy. Let's not let our opponents divine the terms of this debate. Let's constantly remind legislators of the success of this program and make extending the federal ethanol program a prerequisite for election. If public officials can't support the energy security, economic growth, climate change, and job-creating benefits of ethanol, why should we support them? My friends, this year, the stakes are higher than they've ever been. The challenge is made more difficult by a politically polarized Congress. Divisions in agriculture that undermine even our traditional Midwest support. Potential yet unnecessary conflicts within the biofuels industry itself. the emergence of a new and highly motivated coalition in opposition to ethanol generally and E15 specifically, and the continued anti-ethanol bias among East Coast media elites. We'll have to work harder than we've ever had to before to succeed. But I know we can. I know we will. And I know in the end, we will prevail. I'm an optimist. Over the past decade, and especially over the past year, we have taken everything that the economy and all our adversaries could throw at us. And we're still standing. We're united. We are focused on the future. We have overcome every obstacle in our path, and we can face the challenges that lie before us with quiet confidence. This year, and in the years ahead, we need to devise and develop, manufacture and market the first, second, and third generations of biofuels. We can do it. We need to tear down the blend wall and all the barriers to biofuels. We can do it. We must expand and extend the existing federal ethanol program for the long term. We can do that too. We need to answer our adversaries' attacks with facts and tell our story to the world that is hungry for food and fuel. We can do it. And we need to strengthen our alliances and build new partnerships with the global biofuels industry so that together we can fulfill humanity's age-old aspiration to feed the world reliably and fuel the world sustainably. We can do that too. Thomas Edison once said, "Opportunity is missed by most because it is dressed in overhauls and looks like work." There is great opportunity this year. There is much work to be done. And now, as never before, now and forever, we are the ones to get that work done. We can do it. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Environmental Counsel Chuck Knaus.